Thank you. Would you just stand, please, and pray in our own way? Lord, we thank you this day for this wonderful meal and this gathering of friends. We all look forward to what this day will bring us today. We want to ask you to bless each and every one of us here, bless this great country, and especially our soldiers, sailors, and Marines serving overseas. And don't forget the Air Force. Thank you very much for this day. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
We honor our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, we have some elected officials with us today, and start off with Carl Peterjohn, Commissioner. Carl Peterjohn, let's give him a hand. And Judge Phil Journey, who just led us in prayer. Let's give him a big hand. Sheriff Bob Henshaw, let's give him a big hand for being here. And Benny Bowman, the 95th House District Representative. I think I missed anybody, but if I did, hold up your hand. All right. In the weeks ahead, next week, October the 14th, we're going to have Lieutenant Governor Jeff Collier. He's going to give us a roadmap for Kansas, Medicaid reform. On October the 21st, Tripp Shawver, he's an attorney and a mediator, and he's going to talk about the magic of mediation, its uses and benefits. October the 28th, Congressman Tim Huelskamp, and he's going to talk about the spending battles in Washington. So we continue to keep it interesting here. Right, John?
Right.
Well, we had a couple of weeks in the city of Wichita here with the city council. And every once in a while I step out of line and say some things that some of you are not going to appreciate, but I can't help myself, so just close your ears and forget it if you don't like it, but or give me hell after the meeting. But the end taxation for private enrichment. These guys we got on this Wichita City Council. I'll just start out reading here an email that I got this morning from one of the Tea Party people. And we believe that taxes collected are for the support of government programs that benefit all citizens and should never be used for the sole benefit of the companies who collect the taxes. Such actions by the city council diminish the tax base for government programs and relinquish the taxing authority to an unelected set of individuals. Incentives, if used at all, should be for the projects that create good-paying, career-oriented jobs and not a few minimum-wage jobs, giving a building contractor company who gives heavily to campaigns is not a good example of creating jobs. And of course these folks are putting together petitions to try to stop. Hey, if I get in trouble here, John,
oh, we're so good.
What? Since I have to go back and get our guest speaker today.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He was born in 1632, so
I know. He's just arrived.
He has arrived through the modern miracle of technology.
Yes.
We are doing a petition drive. The people have the power of petition. And there's an article that I'd be glad to share with anyone. We are starting a petition drive on the project right across the street. And I will be available if anyone wants to participate in it. There's the talking points on it. And then I can give you instructions on what we have to do if you're interested in participating. So I want to get that in.
That's good. Because I was going to call on you anyway. You've got to go bring our special guest in.
The time capsule program.
Yes. Well, at any rate, we have four Republicans by registration on the city council. Three of them ran into a problem with the numbers on a deal. And one of them, I'm not going to tell you his name. You don't have to work very hard to guess who he was or is. He vacillated. He went back and forth from the Democrat camp to the Republican camp and then back to the Democrat camp when it came time to vote. And it's kind of nice to have a few principles in the camp in which you recognize yourself. And so at any rate, this TIF out at Oliver and 13th became quite an issue at the city council meeting last Tuesday. The person that was involved in that we found out is actually David Burke and David Wells, the most prominent builders that get good deals from the city, as told to us by Alan Bell. Well, turns out this $2.5 million TIF wasn't working too good. So this promoter of this TIF, he decides that he needs to do something different. Now, he doesn't really go make a deal with the city council to redo it. He just goes and makes a deal with Walmart for $1.9 million to sell a piece of this TIF land, and then doesn't describe to anybody what he used the $1.9 million for. And our Michael O'Donnell, he's quizzing him. He finally got him to say that he gave $300,000 of the $1.9 million to buy out somebody who was making these high-priced loans at the corner of the property. So he kind of got cheered for doing that. But the point is we elect these people to look after our interests as taxpayers. And they weren't doing a very good job of looking out for us as taxpayers. And Michael made the statements. Pete Messner agreed, asked for an extra week that we could look into this, get a better understanding of what was going on. And James Clendenin agreed, so there were three of them. Then our other well, I call him a Democrat because he thinks like a Democrat. That's Jeff Longwell. He's a registered Republican, but is he a Democrat? Well, everybody that thinks like I do, if you think like a Democrat, you probably are one. At any rate, as soon as our special guest's here, I'll quit talking. The point is that we were entitled to know the mathematics and distance of this deal. And now it's basically been washed over, covered up, and unless the press or somebody else opens it up, it's what it is. The other thing I'd like to mention is it's going to be an interesting study about water rates. And I've got to ask you, if you were filling up your car with gasoline and you knew that the business next door to the filling station got to buy gasoline cheaper than you did, how would that make you feel? If you bought gasoline and the amount of gasoline you bought last year determined the price for what you got to buy gasoline for this time, wouldn't that be a little bit alarming? That's a lot of database corrections. The facts are that's the way the city of Wichita builds us for water. And they've got special deals, special arrangements, and somehow we need to break that can open and take a look at it. Anyway, it's in the news. It'll be part of the process in the weeks ahead. And when I find out more, I'll let you know. I've talked to the guy. He was too busy to send me the rates. I thought that was interesting. But I'll ask him again and see what happens. The other council meeting that we had a week ago Tuesday was for this project. It's just down over the edge of the building here. You can see it. And these folks are going to end up with about, I believe Bob Weeks can tell me, I think it's $14 million of our tax money, right? Federal, state, that's 7.7.
Well, John, the city says no tax money. I mean, just a little tiny bit. There's a huge dispute over that, so.
Well, it figured out to 1.25 million per council district. Now, is there anything you could do with $1,250,000 in your council districts? Probably a lot. Charlotte Foster's here, and she sent me an email. Let me know some things that could be done in her. Tell us some of those things, Charlotte, that you could do with $1.2 million in District 3.
We could hire some cleanup people to clean up some of the yards. We could fix the streets. Goodness, we could have another.
You could do a lot of things with $1.2 million, couldn't you? Probably all around the city. There's park projects that could be done, things that are actually legitimate functions of government, as I call it. And so it's been an interesting 2 weeks here. He must be having a hard time getting off that spaceship. Been in orbit for a long time. What is the time span for John Locke?
It's correct. What do you mean? Where is he? Born?
Well, when did John Locke live?
1632 to 1704. 1632 to 1704. He was called the father of liberalism, enlightenment, religion, religious tolerance, social contract, all good stuff. But the guy's been dead 300 years.
Well, I hope you all have some questions from that era in time. You'll be fascinated to see how accurately our guest today can answer questions from 300 years ago. He's quite a student of history, and I think you'll find it very interesting if he can just get off that spaceship. Is he coming, Larry?
I don't see
him. At any rate, some of these things that I'm talking about are things that the basic founders of the Pachyderm movement and the Pachyderm clubs. We believe in taking an interest in government, what they're doing, how it's affecting you, and so I really don't apologize for saying some of those things. Might get me in a little trouble, but I said it anyway. Yes, sir.
What do you think of Herman Cain, this rise in the polls and the rise in the popularity?
Well, he's one of the folks that I like. I like some of the others, too. I really haven't picked someone. I'm looking for someone that can lead the country out of the mess we're in. And I see us in being a terrible mess with all the debt, just the regulations on our business. I heard the president of Coca-Cola say it's easier to do business in China than it is America. Now that's a strong statement from one of our largest industrial type personalities, to say that it's easier to do business in China than it is America. And he meant a lot of other countries too. One of the commentators said he's familiar with Japan and other places, and he said we're just getting it so rough over here to do business that we're not going to have any if we don't stop acting this way. Virgil? Oh. Yes, sir.
That's the whole point. Get our jobs to go overseas. Make it tough here so they move over there. Bring us down to third world level.
We got to stop playing that game.
Yeah, but unfortunately, you can't convince them that a 50-cent-an-hour worker is going to buy a product made for $15 in the United States. Whoever
bought
that logic.
You can keep a lot of stupid stuff going with $14.5 trillion worth of borrowed money.
Yeah.
Is that where we play the hanging sign?
Not
you
were
clicking on that.
Uh oh. Uh oh, John Locke's in the building.
Time machine's working.
Time machine is working. We heard you. We heard you, John.
What's
come
the
on in.
Of the petroleum pipeline?
Beg your pardon?
What's the status of the petroleum pipeline? Has Nebraska backed off yet? Is the governor's there?
I don't know. I just heard about a lawsuit and I didn't get the details on it.
Okay. I'll just wait for the door while you announce.
Bring him in.
Bring him in.
Well, folks, we're in for a real treat today. We have John Locke with us. And John, are you ready to come in and talk to us? Let's give him a big hand for being here today.
Ladies and gentlemen, through the miracles of modern technology, and through the walls of time, I introduce Mr. John Locke. And Mr. Locke, I must say that for a man that's 379 years old, you don't look a day over 70.
Well, I attribute that to him drinking lots of alcohol and drinks to sort of preserve myself. Thank you. Delighted to be here today. First of all, let me start by telling you something about myself. I was born in 1632. My father was a lawyer, and the big battle going on was who is going to have the dominant power. The king, the monarch, who claimed to have to rule by divine right, or the legislature, the parliament, as we called it back in England. And my protagonist, a man by the name of Hobbes, was a lackey from the king, and I advocated parliamentary rule to the extent that a government should be allowed to rule. Well, anyway, I had the privilege of going off to Oxford when I was a young man, and I liked it so much that I stayed on there for 34 years. First as a student of philosophy, and then meteorology, and then finally medicine. And one very important thing occurred in that Lord Ashley at the time, who was the leader of the Whig Party, which stood for parliamentary supremacy, became very ill, and he needed surgery. And most of the doctors at that time were afraid to touch it, afraid to take the risk. But I was not. Quite frankly, I was considered quite a good doctor, even though I only practiced part-time. Anyway, I performed this difficult surgery, and he survived very well. And he took a real liking to me, showed his appreciation, by asking me to travel with him, which I did for about 15 years. And we worked together. I gave him advice, and most of the time he took it, sometimes he didn't. But the high mark pretty much was one of the colonies, known as the Carolinas at that time, needed a constitution. And so Lord Ashley did the actual writing. I provided the brain power, and we were able to formulate this constitution, which was considered to be a good accomplishment at the time. Well, anyway, let me tell you about my theory. Or theories, rather. First of all, I hypothesized that basically, I don't claim it to be actual fact, but I wanted to have a starting point. And what I hypothesized was that we probably started in a state of nature. And in that state of nature, unlike Hobbes, who thought that people were nasty and evil and brutish and were always out to get one another, I thought that most people were pretty good, decent human beings. But, and what we were able to use in this original state of nature was the rule of reason. The rule of reason, whereby decent people, using their God-given talents, I am a religious man, are able to deal with each other almost all the time. But there are occasions when reason breaks down. For example, take John Todd and John Stevens. They're good friends, they're neighbors, they want to live near one another. But anyway, John Todd decides to build a well out in the country where they have their residences. And he is approached by his good friend and say, well, you know, you're putting it on my property here. You better stop that digging. Oh no, I've got a deed here that comes from my grandfather. And the other John comes back, but I've got a deed that comes from my great-grandfather. And anyway, these friends start going at it, and so the problem is, there is no impartial judge. John Stevens has a cousin, he said he's a surveyor, he can tell you where it stands. And the other John doesn't trust him there, these former friends. And they go back and forth. But what we need really is some sort of an impartial type of judge, because people have a self-interest when it comes to their personal property, or real property for that matter. Well, property is at the heart of my political theory, because property, in its true sense, consists of not only what we think of as physical property, but also your personal liberty, your ability to reason and think, your ability to preserve your life. I don't advocate that people go out and start wars and try to expand their territories, but on the other hand, I do advocate that if you are attacked, you face danger, that you do what is necessary. And in fact, I'm very proud of the fact that I played a significant role in providing a model for the founding fathers and starting this overall great nation. I'm totally great. But I find some of the things that go on today quite alarming. For example, I read about some character, Alawaki or some name like that, who claimed to be an American citizen, and some of the bleeding hearts said, you can't go and kill a man like that without getting a fair trial. Well, what are you going to do? Go out and find him and serve him a warrant and tell him to appear in court over in the United States? So, you know, you have to use certain common sense here. Well, anyway, what happens in the state of nature, though? You realize that reason isn't going to be enough to do it. You've got to go beyond the state of nature and form a civil society. And in order to do that, you have to not just rely on individuals, but have some sort of governing structure. Not too much, mind you, now. Because as a believer in liberty, I think we all know that people intrude on personal liberties at times too much. I'm reminded, for example, of a case I try to keep current. Professor Sabosky back here is a very wise man. I visit Wichita State every once in a while. And I learned from him that there was a case in Pennsylvania where some very hardworking people had invested their savings and taken out a mortgage and built a model neighborhood. And no crime or anything like that. They wanted to look out for one another. It was a model type of a neighborhood. What comes along? Well, the equivalents of people like Carl Peterjohn, for example, in Princeton, they decide we can make more money if we condemn this property and make it into a shopping center. This is ridiculous. But more important, it violates basic property rights. It violates your liberty. And it is just inexcusable in that regard. Well, for better or worse, and I think it was for better, whereas England did not accept my idea of separating the powers and having certain checks, the founding fathers in America decided, in their hopefully infinite wisdom, that they would adopt a lot of the ideas I had, even though my native England rejected it. And so in the Constitution, it provides for the fact that the powers are separated. Now, the legislature is supposed to be supreme. But in actuality, what a lot of people don't realize is that when we set up a system of government, it is what we call a fiduciary type of trust. And there is the trustor who actually decides on what it will be. This precedes any kind of government as such. And there's also a beneficiary to the trust. And in my system, I provide that the people are both the trustor and the beneficiary. Now, there's also a trustee involved, and that's primarily in the hands of the legislature. But this is a significant difference between me and that myself and other political theorists. To me, the trustee doesn't have any rights. It has obligations. And it is expected to live up to these obligations. And too often we find that these trustees are more interested in taking care of themselves than taking care of their people. For example, a lot of these trustees like to tax and tax and tax. Well, I advocate this, that no legislative body ought to be admitted, ought to be permitted to inflict a tax on the people without a vote by the people themselves. I think that's giving too much power. Well, I say that this trustee here is coming over here, so I'm glad that he's latched on to the wisdom that I presented here today. Now, I also realize this. Anybody here ever served in the legislature? Okay. Well, your time might have been different, but in general, legislatures are debating societies, and they debate, and they debate, and they debate. And often it takes action that can't wait, like whether you're going to decide to go to war or whatever it is, And for that reason, I do provide the executive with some power. At times it can be significant. And it comes under what I call the right of prerogative. Under prerogative, you can act in an emergency. Now, as I look back and reflect, the only problem is, what is an emergency? One of your presidents, Lyndon Johnson, decides that he wants to go to war and he invents a phony attack on an American ship that says we've got to defend ourselves. Obviously, the legislature wants some protection. And in your country, you have this War Powers Act. Well, it's never really been enforced as such. And so these are unsettled matters. So my system, my model is not perfect here. Also, there's another factor involved. You can see segments of it today. Most people who are elected to a legislative body do not want to retire. They like the perks. I mean, what a deal the President and Congress had. Some years ago, they voted themselves automatic pay increases unless they vote to override it. Just how many times that their automatic pay increase has been overridden. Another thing they don't want to do is to give up their seats. Now, we had a situation in England whereby every shire, the equivalent of your legislative district, would get one vote. And anyway, England, Liverpool, and larger areas that were expanding constantly, in contrast to these little shires that had more cows than people, were getting outvoted, even though most of the population resided in the larger cities. So I do give the executive the power to reapportion when the legislature refuses to do so. Now, at the same time, the executive has to be accountable to the legislature. But even more important, in my system, the legislature should be accountable to the people.
To the people, not to themselves.
And that's one of the things I regret, is the way in which my system has been misapplied in that regard. Now, as part of property, and too often they list property last, but it's the most important because it subsumes all these other factors, like life and liberty, too often these are violated. And also, a lot of times they come in conflict with one another. Let me give you an example. Maybe some of you might want to comment on this. In fact, Professor Sabowski invited me to one of his classes, and I raised the question, and there was a lot of disagreement. And the example was that there was a couple who were quite religious, and they were involved in an automobile accident with their little infant son. And so they were taken by ambulance to the emergency room, and the parents turned out to just have little scrapes. They were okay. The doctor on call told the parents that your baby's life, we think, can be saved if we give him a blood transfusion. The parents looked at each other and they pointed out, our religion tells us that the Holy Book says, thou shalt not take unto thyself the love, the blood of another. And for that reason, we do not want to condemn our son to violating God's law. And the physician in the emergency room points out, if he doesn't get the blood transfusion, he will die. And they argue back and forth. Finally, the emergency room doctor calls on the chief of staff, and he explains to the people that their interpretation is incorrect, that he is a religious man, but that this is a misinterpretation of the Holy Book. And therefore, that pertains to murdering a person or getting involved in a war, but not to a needed blood transfusion. The parents are adamant. And so the chief of medical staff gets the district judge on the phone and tells the judge that he wants him to issue a restraining order to stop these doctors from interfering with the eternal life of the son. Because what happens on earth, life or death, is just temporary. What happens in the eternity is what is really important. Now, I'll ask you the question. What should the judge decide in this case? Does he respect the idea of the religious liberty of the parents? who have a responsibility for the care of their child, and they're more interested in eternal life? Or should it be a doctor working for a state hospital who decides that this infant needs a blood transfusion in order to save life? And I left out one thing. The judge asked the father to get on the phone. And the father pointed out to him, he said, you know, I'd like to hear your reasons you yourself are offering. And he says that my brother was involved in a very serious car accident. He was taken in critical condition to the emergency room. The doctor asked his wife to give permission for a blood transfusion. They belong to the same religion we do, and she refused to grant it. He lived. I also know of other experiences of members of my church who were told that their mates would suffer death if they did not have a transfusion. They had the transfusion and they died anyway. We believe the decision is in God's hand, not in somebody who has a medical degree. Now the question I would like to ask you all is this. What should the judge decide in this case? Does he grant an injunction of taking the expertise of the doctors to say what they think will be a life, or do they go with the religious liberty of the parents? We'd like to take that. Yes?
I'll take that. Individual freedom is a priority for us. I honestly believe in my heart that he should allow the father to have his parental right granted according to his religious belief. So that's the direction I would recommend.
Okay.
And even though it might result one way or the other.
Who disagrees? Tony?
Well, I'm not disagreeing, but you think the judge would go back in his private chambers and toss a coin?
No. No? In this particular case, the judge didn't make a decision.
Did not.
Did.
What decision did he make?
Well, let's hear a little discussion first.
I say, okay.
It's okay to do it because the child has liberty rights as well. You don't leave your liberty rights until you're 21 at the door.
Well, some people would interpret, though, that the child is incapable of exercising these, and his parents, under the concept of in loco parentis, have that responsibility.
Yes. They're failed to discharge.
Okay.
Well, what about child abuse, though? I mean, if the child's life is in danger because the parents were disciplining this child in a, you know, severe manner, and his life is at stake, you know, you would expect that the authorities would intervene. And is this, I mean, are we not stepping on parental rights in that case as well?
Other opinions? Yes.
I think now, legally, when you admit someone to the hospital, they go to the emergency room, the family gives up their legal rights. They have, the rights are in the hands of the
Well, I'd like to ask you to put aside what, you know, the current practice is and what the current law might be, and I'm raising an ought type of question. What ought to prevail in this situation? Yes?
Well, barring any other circumstances than what you've said, I side with the parents. Not that I think it's a wise decision, but unfortunately, if we give the government the power, they're eventually going to come down to where they can tell you what to eat.
Here, here.
And when you can eat.
Shell's doing it already.
And everything else. So therefore, I hold with the parents. And they have the ultimate responsibility as long as there's no other intervening circumstances. If they cause the injury, take them to jail. But in this case, what you've dictated, I go with the parents. Because otherwise, you're going to have the government tell you what you can eat and when you can eat.
Charlie?
I'm going to go with the doctors on this one. Necessary to save the child's life. We have no reason to believe that the child will be permanently harmed by this, and we should recover.
From the Bible, according to his parents' interpretation.
I was referring to in their life as a human, not after. And I think it's the state's interest to protect the rights of the child, which is to allow them to survive.
Yeah.
I believe the child has a right to life. It's not our choice to decide that that child is not going to live. So the doctor, by oath, has to do everything that they can possibly do to save that child's life.
I suggest we get them a modern version of the Bible.
Well, then the judge has an option here. Sure, since you're out in the everyday world, if the judge would give you a call before making his decision, what would you advise you?
Two things come to mind. Number one, from the position of honoring the parents' choice for their child, to me, that's the same rationale when you're talking, the question comes up, pro-life versus pro-choice. So, and everyone has strong feelings on that. The other thing that came to mind is it reminded me of a story where guys on top of the cops come by and says, a flood's coming, you need to evacuate, no, God will protect. Pretty soon the water rises, he gets on the roof, and a helicopter flies over and says, let me lower down a ladder, you know, you're gonna die, no, God will protect. Eventually he dies, he ends up at the pearly gates, and says, why didn't you protect me? And God's response was, well, I sent you a cop, I sent you a rowboat, I sent you a helicopter, what do you want?
Well, as we've seen,
and you notice how I really didn't answer your question.
Who's the elected official?
You've got a great future ahead in politics. But what I'm trying to do is to point out to you that a lot of these questions have no easy answers. I don't claim to be as good as Aristotle, but I'm rated a pretty outstanding philosopher, political philosopher, as far as the historians go. And what I thought was, you know, a ready solution at the time turns out, when you face up to reality, to have difficulties involved. Now let me, as I come here and I listen to these little snippets on unbiased places like MSNBC and Fox News and so forth, I noticed that both these people who call themselves Democrats and Republicans are for the parts of my philosophy that I like. I think a lot of people here would agree that we should not just be giving handouts to people, helping them survive permanently on welfare and all. I believe that work is honorable, whether it's physical or mental, and that people ought to be encouraged to work, even in an emergency situation, if you want to help them out. And so I don't buy that. I also don't buy the idea of subsidizing people who call themselves capitalists, and saying that they believe in free enterprise, and yet they want handouts from the government and special tax breaks and all. So if I were alive today, I would, like I understand Carl Prejean is, would be a libertarian. And if I were involved in a presidential campaign, I would be for Ron Paul, because I believe that you have a right to defend yourself, but not to just go and get involved in places that don't directly affect you. And so I believe there's a lot of discredit to go around in both the Democratic and Republican parties. I don't apologize if I have offended anybody here. I don't think there are too many Democrats here today. But I just want to tell you that somebody before, I forget who it was, mentioned to me that I ought to praise Thomas Jefferson's, well, I don't go along with Jefferson. Jefferson was the one who wrote very eloquently about freedom of expression, and yet he had Federalist editors thrown in prison as such. He tried to remove his cousin, John Marshall, from the Supreme Court because he didn't like his decisions. And then he had what I think is rather absurd. He grossly extended what I believe that people have a right to, you know, change their governments, to say that we ought to have a revolution every 30 years. As he said, blood is the manure that fertilizes the soil. And he also believed that every 30 years, all debt should be wiped out. Anybody here a mortgage broker? But anyway, it's interesting how certain people lionize, and they have people thinking that they're in my condition when they're really not. So I stand for liberty of all types, but liberty is not license. I disagree with the ACLU, who would defend anybody at any time, no matter how absurd the idea might be or how dangerous it might be. And so for that reason, I would not be an advocate of Fred Phelps practicing his religious freedom when he and his followers picket the funerals of people who've given their all for their country. And so I believe that these things have to be leavened with some common sense as such. Yes?
A question, Mr. Locke. Slavery was commonplace back in your time and era, and there was a little dust up in 1689 called the Glorious Revolution. I'd appreciate your comments on both those subjects, please.
Well, I must say that I, like a lot of people, can be inconsistent at times. And that at times, since I was on the payroll of Lord Ashley, and he was a believer in slave holding and so forth, I went along. But on later reflection, and I think this has happened with many of your countrymen, I would be against slavery today. In fact, one of the interesting people in your history is a chap by the name of Abraham Lincoln. And I was quite amused, this was a disadvantage of not having swift communication. One week he gave a talk in the North how he was full square, full equality for people of the African race, as he put it. 2 weeks later in Richmond, Virginia, he let the people know that he had always been against the idea that the black man in any way was equivalent to the white man. In other words, he adjusted himself to his audience. One of the advantages you have, along with the disadvantages of instant communication, is the hypocritical type things, you know, can be exposed and people can be caught up with in that regard. But I would not today be an advocate of slavery, but I was sort of a kept man at the time. None of us was perfect, and so I plead guilty to that. Yes, Toby?
Well, John Locke, put forward your idea of the Constitution and all the things that happened. How come you didn't suggest or put in a thing where the Constitution could protect itself?
Well, I didn't write the Constitution, but I was a model here. And there are things in there about providing for treason, for example, although there are exemptions whereby the executive can grant, you know, when you get as old as I am, the words have always come to you here. But, for example, if you capture a spy who can give you secrets and so forth, you might make a deal not to hang him as such. But there are things in your Constitution that I did not write, I was a model for, that does provide for the punishment for treason.
Yeah, but today we have cases, lots of cases, where the anti-Americans use the Constitution to destroy the Constitution. How would you address that?
I believe that the present generation struggle with that. See, one of the advantages of being a philosopher is that you can talk more in terms of abstract ideas rather than having to produce the actual solutions. We leave it to the so-called public servants to do that. And sometimes I think they do a good job, and other times they don't. Yes.
Commissioner Peter John, ask you, sir, about where did you stand on the Gentle Revolution of 1688-89?
I was very much for it. Yeah. The idea was to do away with this absurdity that the king rules by divine right, that somehow he has a special message from God that he is to rule. I think that's totally beside the point. But I also don't think that a legislature should be able to do anything that it wants to. It has to be accountable to the people. I like the idea of having a referendum and a responsible recalls, although I remember one instance where a member of this group by the name of Darrell Thorpe was recalled when he had enough guts to stand up against a dictatorial superintendent of schools supported by the local Beagle newspaper here. And people can get it wrong, there's no guarantee. But more often than right than not, I would put more faith in the common people than I would the officials. We have too much power of gravitating to the so-called elite. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Locke, observers of the UN said that you have two issues or perhaps two problems. One is you have the social contract. What do you do with dissidents? People say, I never agreed to that social contract, and yet I'm locked into the society. You say I have to obey you. Why do I have to obey you? I didn't vote for you in the legislature. I didn't agree to this. I'm just here by an accident of birth. And the other issue, of course, is when is it justified, whether it's a king or a legislator saying you've gone too far trampling natural rights, we have a right to, one, not obey you, and two, even to revolt and use bloodshed?
Okay, good question. On the first question, what I provide is this. While people who were born later after the social contract was agreed to, and the social contract isn't the government, it's an agreement to create a society. Then after that becomes this fiduciary trust that I talked about. My answer to that is, if an individual finds himself with things that he disagrees with strongly enough, he can move. But if he stays, then he is obligated. In other words, you can't have everybody just doing his own thing. On the other hand, in terms of dissent, I believe that is very, very important. For example, I must give credit to the colonists, for example. And in fact, along those lines, I'm a very strong believer in the negative political campaigns, as long as they're compatible with the truth. And for example, colonists, have conducted a negative campaign against my own country, Great Britain. And as a result of that, pamphleteers like Thomas Paine, for example, they were able to rally support from among people, and they committed what would be regarded as treasonous behavior to the British government, but I think it was essential. They ran a very negative campaign to arouse public support. I think that right is very integral to any kind of a reasonable function type of society. But then, what if things get so unbearable, and you try whatever you can within the confines of the law and all, and you try to use persuasion, and that doesn't work, then you have the right, which I try to be diplomatic and call an appeal to God. And an appeal to God is the right of revolution. If everything else fails, if you perceive that abuses are occurring in terms of mistreatment, of just an excess in terms of taxation and being imprisoned for dissenting ideas, then I believe you have the right, in fact, I would say even the obligation to rebel, as the colonists did. In fact, I must say that I know some Democrats at the university who get very upset with the Tea Party. I think that the Tea Party is good for what you call your Republican-style democracy, that they are dissenters. They are bringing issues to the public. And for that reason, if they can influence the party that they're in, and they can get certain policies adopted, more power to them, despite what some of these Democratic presidents want to do. I believe that people have the right to protest at abortion clinics. I believe also that hippie-type people have a right to protest at, on Wall Street, as long as they're not interfering with other people entering the place of business. So I believe dissent is very, very important. Yes?
We have, you talked about referendum. We have today a group of people in this town that are starting an effort to protest and overturn a decision made by the Wichita City Council recently, and we hear that most of our elected officials and bureaucrats in City Hall are very angry that this is happening. It sounds like your advice to these leaders would be to just sit back and trust the judgment of the people. Is that right?
Consider the arguments. Sometimes leader has to use his or her own best judgment here. And for example, a lot of technology is involved today. I believe it would be absurd for people in government to just rely on what public opinion is if it doesn't have sufficient evidence. So I think there are times when a legislator has to take what we call the Burkean approach and weigh the desires of the people. Now, it's not too hard for a senator, because if it happens early in his term, he has time to let it forget. Or if you're a clever politician like Romney is, You can quote Winston Churchill and say, it is a poor leader who won't change his mind, and justify, you know, being back and forth and so forth. So I don't think there is an automatic answer. On the other hand, if you're interested in re-election, you better not be too far ahead of the people. Just like the Supreme Court will very often follow the election returns. After Franklin Roosevelt had a lot of his proposed legislation rejected, and a lot of it rightfully so, it was hastily drawn. In fact, Roosevelt used to say, I'm like a quarterback. I try one thing, if it doesn't work, I'll try something else. And what happened is he inherited a very conservative Supreme Court. People let it be known what they thought, and Justice Owen Roberts, who was with the majority, shifted over to call the ship and save nine. So sometimes I think you have to go against public opinion. And the people, if they feel strongly enough about it, can change the Constitution. Thankfully, it's not easy to do, so that you're not just, you know, influenced by whims. But, you know, if it's really strongly felt, you will have changes, as occurred in terms of public opinion was overwhelmingly for slavery. And anyway, in terms of the political situation, this was finally overturned. In modern times, I would suspect that a man like Martin Luther King, being confrontational, conducting sit-ins and things like that, being willing to go to jail when he violated the law and was arrested, these kind of things can bring about a change on the part of policymakers. And today, African Americans, I think, have a better life than they did before this kind of confrontational politics took place. It's far from perfect, but none of us live in a perfect world. Yes, Mark?
Yeah, Mr. Locke, you grew up in a time where the mercantilist philosophy was the theory of the day. And it wasn't until your friend Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations that the thinking was that not every nation can hoard gold. And they realized that wealth is really in the product created between nations and not so much in the gold hoarded in that one individual nation. With that in mind, what would you, John Locke, think about NAFTA?
If it benefited this country, I think that the country should get on board. If they can enforce the other countries from selling shoddy goods at cheap prices and all, but if there's nothing to be gained, then I would be against it. So a lot depends, as the current politicians say, the devil is in the details. But I would make my criteria, does it benefit or harm the country? And if you can work out a good trade deal, fine. If you can't, forget it. Yes?
I have a two-part question. First of all, I think that you, John Locke, was the author of the Commonwealth System. And is Kansas a Commonwealth?
I don't know. I've just been in Kansas temporarily every once in a while, and I just don't know what the system here is. Even people who have, you know, high publicity and so forth and are built up don't know all the answers. I just don't know. Yeah.
John, how long are you going to stay with us?
Well, to about 1:15 when I have to be picked up and be taken to the Concord in Chicago to go back to England, my trip there.
Thank you. Philosopher John Locke, let's give him a big hand.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Locke, before you get out of costume, I'd like to take advantage of having you sign your second treatise of government.
Oh, yes.
Do you mind backdating it to 1690? It would be more valuable to me. I'm an opportunist and also a capitalist.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet Professor Mel Kahn. Let's say the word to you. Mel has been a professor of political science at Wichita State University since 1970. Teaching awards include the Carnegie Foundation's selection as Kansas Professor of the Year and the Regents Award for Excellence in Teaching. His published books include The Winning Ticket, Daily,
the Machine, and the Illinois Politics and the Politics of American Labor. He has also presented papers at several national conferences, CONTOT in the 1996 GOP National Convention Intern Program, and was a delegate and platform committee member at two Democratic National Conventions. His other works nationally include a presentation at the U.S. Court of Appeals Second Circuit Annual Conference. Locally, I have witnessed Mel's excellent portrayals of Alexander Hamilton, Plato, and now John Locke. In addition to his honors and accolades, Mel asked me to tell you that he flunked the first grade.
So there's hope for everybody.
Perhaps I need to give Mel a moment to defend himself on that one.
Well, it's a teacher's fault, of course. No, I still vividly remember. I don't think they had a retirement in those days. She seemed about 90, and she told my mother that in all her years of teaching, I was by far, and she used this word, the stupidest pupil she ever had, and she guaranteed I would never learn to read or write. My mom always maintained, she said it correct, I never did learn to write legibly.
Thank you. Please join me in giving Professor Melkon a hearty thank you for the wonderful presentation.
I just wanted to give a little further explanation on something I was mentioning earlier. The City Council passed a mechanism or device where these folks who are putting in this hotel can charge, Bob Weeks, you correct me if I'm wrong, a 6% tax. And then they're going to give the 75% of that tax back to the hotel. Well, you know, that's kind of like 75%. That's a lot of the tax you collect going back in your own pocket. So at any rate, there are some petitions to possibly make that not the way it is. Is that right, Bob?
Pretty much, yeah.
You want to add anything to that?
We have them available up here if anyone needs it after
the week. The guest tax you talked about, John, is a tax that every hotel charges. Normally that tax goes to fund the citywide tourism and convention fund. In this case, most of it, 75%, is going right back to the hotel. The hotel has a lot of other subsidies, but this subsidy was passed with a special form of law known as a charter ordinance, and we have the ability to protest a charter ordinance. We don't have the ability to protest the other ordinance, and that's what this petition drive is about. The political reality is, I think, that this will be played out as an entire referendum. The opponents will say on the future of downtown Wichita, we say on the future of subsidized crony capitalist development of downtown Wichita. I think there's a big distinction that the opponents will not admit.
How many signatures, and when do you have to turn the petitions in?
We need 2,500 approximately signatures from 60 days from today is the first day. So
we have a distinguished guest with us today. He came in a little late, but one of my favorite people, former Sheriff Gary Sneed. Let's give him a big hand for being here. Get to see you very often. Are you doing well, Gary?
I'm doing very well. I always think of my friends down here, Pachyderm, and try to get down here. Unfortunately, in retirement, you get pretty busy sometimes. Yeah. I had the opportunity to slip in late today and thought I'd do it so I could say it.
Well, we appreciate you being here. Thanks for coming. We'll see you next week.
That was fun. Good to see you, John.
I'll see you.
A lot of people saw it.